this is Lucy Duncan, and I'm the director of Friends Relations. And this is a call for spirited action. This is the last call in this series, and then we'll be starting them up again in October. They're monthly phone calls about the issues that AFSC works on and a time to engage with AFSC program staff. And tonight, I'm really grateful that we've got Alyssa Wilson, who works on Africa policy in D.C., and Aura Kanegas, who's the director of the Office for Public Policy and Advocacy for AFSC, on the line, and to talk about Shared Security, which is a document, as many of you may know, that was developed out of a consultation with many Quakers and many experts in their field and on particularly around foreign policy that proposes a new way to think about U.S. foreign policy. And we've been developing that. It was a document that was developed in collaboration with FCNL, and both FCNL and AFSC have continued to develop the ideas and implement them more deeply into our work. And so Alyssa and Aura are going to talk about that. But before we begin, it would be wonderful to hear who's on the call, say what your name is and what meeting you're calling in from, and perhaps one question that you might throw out there for Alyssa and Aura to consider as we begin. And I want to let you all know that we are recording the call so that so that others can listen in after tonight. So Alyssa and Aura, why don't you start, and then we'll go around.
This is Alyssa Wilson. I'm the Public Education and Advocacy Coordinator for Africa, and I am an international program staff member who is based out of the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy in Washington, D.C.
Great, thank you. And Aura?
Hi, this is Aura Kanegas. I'm the Director of the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy for AFSC in Washington, D.C., and I'm currently in a little bit of transit from one place to the next, but looking forward to talking to you.
Great. And it was a little hard to hear you, but I'll let you know if we're having trouble. Okay, who else is on the call?
Hi, Lucy. This is Michael Verkel from Richmond, Indiana, calling with my wife.
I'm Gwen Halstead. We're from Clear Creek Meeting in Richmond, and our meeting is going to be having a shared security discussion in the next month, and so we thought we would get the preview from you folks.
Wonderful. Great. Thanks. Wonderful to have you with us. Is there a question that you have, or do you just want to listen first?
Mostly listen for me.
Stand here. That's fine.
Okay, great.
So
okay,
I'm
who else is on?
Hello?
Go ahead.
I'm Susan Strong from Strawberry Creek Meeting, and I'm the co-clerk of our Peace, Earth, Care, and Social Witness Committee. And we did some work on shared security when it first came out, and we're looking forward to hearing what you're doing now.
Wonderful. Who else is on the call?
This is Martha Yeager, AFSC staff in Southeast New England, and it's always helpful for me to just hear how you all are talking about this so that I sing the same song.
Okay, great. And is anybody else on the call that wants to introduce themselves? Okay. We'll go ahead and get started. So, Aura, are you okay with going ahead with your first part, or do you want Alyssa to begin?
Yes. Let me know if it gets too noisy in the background to hear me, and I just give way, but I'll give it a try. So, the shared security frame is really about building our ability to articulate, advocate, and mobilize for a new narrative of well-being, and really recapture a deeper meaning of security. So the shared security concept reframes the deep-seated us versus them kind of zero-sum game narrative that governs our current approaches to personal and community, national, global well-being, and really seeks to reclaim the language of security for a framework for lasting peace and justice. As we've seen, particularly in the last 12 years, security is currently construed as being used to justify murder, racism, wide-scale repression of human rights. Shared security really works to challenge that narrative with the idea that true, sustainable security must incorporate the needs and rights of all people. This fundamental idea has become a guide to post-race reframing of issues related to foreign policy, and has also inspired efforts to strengthen and deepen our ability to challenge the prevailing narratives of fear, scarcity, and militarism from the domestic to the global level. So tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about the origins of this framework. I think we kind of came into it from a narrower lens and discovered it was something that could serve us more broadly. So the roots of this came actually in the lead up to the 2008 election when AFSC convened a number of the groups that we work with in various contexts, all of whom were working on aspects of the U.S. role in the world, but they were not necessarily working with each other. So peace movement groups and humanitarian aid groups and environmental groups, people working on a lot of pieces of the puzzle but not necessarily together. And we worked together to develop a set of recommendations for whoever won that election. The process was a constructive one, and we learned a lot. And when Obama won that election, we presented the results of our work to the transition team. And we advanced a popular version of the document as the Roadmap for Peace, which some of you might have heard about at the time. Incidentally, on the Obama transition team, we met with Gail Smith, who was someone who several months earlier had been one of the experts whose advice we sought in drafting the document. So she's now been nominated to head the USAID. So with people like Gail Smith on the inside, many of us have high hopes for the Obama administration. Some of the leading thinkers on changing the system in the ways we were seeking we're now in positions of power. We saw an administration that talked and talked that sounded a lot like our own. But Washington is not built for change, and though some incredibly committed change makers came to join that administration, fundamentally we saw it making some of the same foreign policy assumptions and pursuing the same similarly militarized approaches as the previous administration. So, you know, this really came to a head for some of us watching the military intervention in Libya unfold and really mourning the lost possibilities of any kind of alternative view playing out. And Bridget Moik, who some of you may be familiar with, who was on staff of FBNL at the time, and I sat down and had a conversation at one of those moments again where Quakers are again asked, like, well, what would you do? Let people die? And if you really, as if the two choices were war or doing nothing. And we had a conversation about long arc movements that friends have been central to and what made them work, how we could get to a different frame overall than we were sitting in today. And we talked about abolition and the civil rights movement, change movements that took generations, and of course never delivered full transformation, but nonetheless over generations of work accomplished badly needed changes that were very deep-seated in society and that could not have been imagined by most people at the onset. So we asked ourselves what stood between us and a transformed world where war was a thing of the past, where it was looked back on as the barbaric and ineffective practice we know it to be, and where individual and community well-being were cared for universally rather than for the haves alone. Where the realities of conflict were addressed with systems that were just, humane, and structured to promote human rights and the common good. And And kind of marinating in that vision, we thought it might be helpful to try to articulate a Quaker vision for a fully transformed U.S. foreign policy. We had had the exercise of a kind of coalition effort in 2008, but we wanted to really articulate the things that friends talk about in parcels and maybe know to be true or speak in our truth, but that at least in recent years hadn't been fully articulated in ways that we do up. So we were looking not for a utopia, whitewashed of challenges, but a set of underlying assumptions, tools, and reflexes that could be in place that would take us away from rather than toward violent conflict. And what we saw with the Obama administration was really that while their intentions might have been different, the tools were the same, the set of sort of instincts to do something were the same, and the sense that somehow military engagement was decisive in a way that nothing else could see was the same. So we began to try to articulate that alternative for him. And we knew there were no right answers, but that asking it would stretch friends in ways that we hoped would be helpful. We developed a first draft, and then we seasoned it with a number of weighty friends, and then we convened a group in person of Quakers in which we strove for diversity in racial, ethnic, socioeconomic, and age makeup, but we also sought a broad spectrum of foreign policy experience and approaches to change. So we had individuals whose resumes included their hundreds of arrests over the course of their change-making accomplishments, and others who worked at the highest levels of the Pentagon. Others had lived through genocide in their home countries, and still others headed prestigious business schools. The point was really the journey and the conversation more than the end point, and the discussions were very rich. So the shared security name itself emerged from these discussions with friends. They were an effort to take a term so loaded, used as a tool to justify so much we did not believe in, and really urge a wholesale rethink of its true meaning. Because security at its fundamental core is simply a synonym for well-being. And security as we live it today in no way resembles a state of well-being. So the shared security framework builds upon and beyond existing concepts of human security and global security. We've encouraged people not to focus on the document itself, as it, you know, is inherently imperfect and not meant to be otherwise. But to use it as a jumping off place for their own discussions and dreams about what could and should replace the deeply flawed, violent, and really unequal framework that governs current global policy. So we focused on four organizing principles for our vision. The first was peaceful ends through peaceful means. The second was a planetary imperative to care for our common home. The third was global cooperation and rule of law. And the fourth was restorative approaches to healing broken rights, bringing some of the concepts of restorative justice to the global arena. So while the document ultimately articulates a range of components, concrete components that we see as important to a transformed system, perhaps the most important concept is just a simple top line. Our nation's definition of security has to change to include the well-being of all people and the planet we share. The only true security is security that's shared. So an effort to protect my well-being at the expense of your human rights or your human needs will not work out well for long. So I'm going to pause for a moment. How are we... looking at time, and let me just close with saying one more thing, which is that obviously this concept and the principles within the shared security frame have implications that go far beyond the realm of foreign policy. So a flippant worldview from us versus them to us all thinking could solve challenges that we face at all levels in our society, from family to community to the society and the nation and the world as a whole. Some of the staff working in areas of healing justice and economic justice within AFSC got really excited about the possibilities that the frame we advanced could offer for the domestic sphere, and there's been slow but steady movement towards developing a similar framework
that speaks to rethinking our approaches to law enforcement, criminal justice, immigration policy, and economics. Our colleagues in IT have begun to build a strong network of plans and staff structures to build the shared security concept out into global context. And, you know, the moment is really ripe for this. I think we've seen public attention to the ongoing reality of the deep societal costs of militarized policing and punitive law enforcement models. And at the same time, we've seen that globally the reflex to reach for military responses in situations like the rise of ISIS are once again proving to be just extremely ineffective. We think the moment is right for really working for culture shift and for communicating a concrete set of effective alternatives. So we're now working to articulate just a simple shared security 2.0 framing that gives that more universal to Alyssa now for some of the ways staff and AFSC's international programs are framed into the context in which we work.
Fabulous. Hello.
You mean, oh, yeah, okay.
Oh,
go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So, oh, well, you might want to go on mute. Oh, fabulous. I am
muted now, so I don't know if others can use also.
I was going to start by talking about, you know, international programs and, you know, our big plans and everything, but I thought, because I was just talking to Martha at the very beginning, that I might talk a little bit about my work first, just to kind of ground things in kind of really practical terms. So as I said, I'm the Public Education and Advocacy Coordinator for Africa, and what that is I bring lessons learned from our programming in Burundi, Zimbabwe, Somalia, and Kenya to the policy community in the United States. And I think you could kind of say that even though I'm an international program staff person, in kind of a broader sense, I'm a shared security staff person. So really trying to bring ideas about what it means to look at a framework that says that, you know, countries and people are in this together, and so we need to kind of use peaceful ends to create peaceful means because it's the best thing for everyone. And so there are some different contexts where I work. One example for some of you who've, you know, read the document might sound familiar, is about Somalia and some of the work that we're doing with young people and some of the work that could be done kind of in a broader scale if there weren't some of the U.S. counterterrorism laws that make it difficult for American organizations or any organization that is funded with U.S. dollars to function. And that's the idea that organizations from the U.S. or those funded by the U.S. cannot work with individuals that are on the foreign terrorist organization list. And what that means for organizations working in certain areas, so like if AFSC is running peacebuilding programming for young people, we're technically not supposed to work with any young people who've been involved with Al-Shabaab, even though one might argue that those are exactly the young people that we'd love to come and do programs that give livelihoods, information, like how you can make money and not belong to an armed group and how you can, you know, learn the skills to support your community. And so one of the things that I do as an advocacy person is I try to figure out how we can change that legislation and create new opportunities for more organizations to be engaged in this work legally, because having a prohibition against doing peacebuilding work does not promote a vision where, you know, all of our security is intertwined with one another's. And I'll say that there is going to be more of this kind of work happening from international programs. Right now, I am the only public education and advocacy coordinator. And then there's Michael Merriman Lopps, who has a different title but does work very similar to what I do in terms of doing advocacy in the U.S. About international issues and trying to make it so that the U.S. doesn't stand in the way of peace building and progress in other places. There will also be other public education advocacy coordinators. That's part of how international programs is responding to this new idea of shared security, so that each region has a person whose job it is to really try to bring those lessons learned to the U.S. policy community. I should say that I also liaise with the Quaker United Nations office in New York and work very closely with them. So Asia is going to have someone like me, and Latin America eventually will also have someone like me. We will also have counterparts in a position that might sound familiar to many people. The choir program is going to come back to the Quaker International Affairs Representatives, and they will be based in the regions looking at trends in the regions, policy work, advocacy opportunities, maybe working with, someone upstairs from me is moving furniture, maybe working with regional bodies like the African Union or the East African Community or the or ASEAN, like the body in Southeast Asia, and seeing how we can take AFSC lessons learned and bring our partners to places where policy is made that is affecting the communities that we are working with. And so I think it's really exciting. We're all very excited that cumulatively in the next 3 years, because the pilot project is going to last for about 3 years, we will have eight new people, or we'll have eight positions that are filled that are looking at advocacy and policy and really trying to amplify the voices of the communities that we are partnering with so that those voices and those ideas can be represented from the community level to the highest sort of like international governance levels. And I kind of was thinking about this work, and I created what I felt like if global shared security had a mission statement. I took this from kind of a document that we were creating, and I said that it would be to help lift up voices of local leaders, partners, and policymakers in order to advocate for solutions at the international community level that actually respond to the needs of local communities. So we'll be doing this by making sure that country teams and regions can come together and create strategies, and then each region will use convening funds, like the Dialogue and Exchange programs that can bring people together on South-South exchanges to continue to build networks where they are and help people in the different places where we work come together and kind of envision what they want to see happen. And then at another kind of quorum-creating body, some of the IP leadership, like regional directors, will work with communications to do a mapping to look at kind of where AFSC can have some really great input. Like I said, this is going to be kind of a three-year process helped by folks like me, the public education advocacy coordinators, and the new Quaker International Affairs representatives who are going to be hired. We're going to be working a lot with communications and somewhat doing work with monitoring and evaluation for any geeky people like me who want to make sure that, you know, this long-term work, sometimes it's, you know, if someone has to go back and say, let's do a monitoring and evaluation plan for abolition, you know, that's like, you know, over a 100-year time span. And we really want to make sure that the work we do, even though, you know, we want to make sure we're being efficient and doing things in a timely manner, in a smart way, that that we're really allowing for those longer time spans, because often that's how, you know, the really deep work is happening. And so I've said some about, you know, advocacy that's happening, you know, towards the U.S. and then so the regional body work, but there are also going to be some exciting programs that are happening within the region in terms of programmatic elements. So like in the Middle East, with the Israel program, they're going to be looking at shared security through addressing the military-industrial complex and security complex that's in Israel, doing public dialogues about the cost, profit, and hidden interests, and exploring the ramifications of the military connections between Israel, the United States, and other countries, and what those ramifications are for people in Israel. Like, what does it mean that they're spending so much money and a lot of their, you know, major relationships are about the military? You know, what other things are being neglected in society? And then in Latin America, they're going to be doing a cross-border civil society program that's going to span Mexico and the U.S. and kind of look at people who are migrating even up through Mexico. What does that journey look like? And what are some of the ideas on immigration policy throughout that whole journey that people who have taken it have that organizations like AFSC can kind of amplify, and organizations in Mexico can amplify, so that they can impact on policy on immigration and security throughout the region. And so I think there's just some really exciting moments for collaboration that are kind of coming down the pipeline in terms of being inspired by these shared security ideas. So I'll end there.
Great. Thank you, Alyssa. And, yeah. Ora, you want to talk about the U.S. and China relationship? You may have been muted.
Ora, you're still on mute.
Now you should be okay now, Ora.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, great. I think I tangled myself up with the star sixes and sevens. So about 2 weeks ago, we had the second of convening with a Chinese counterpart organization that we had held a convening with a year ago in Ningxia, China. We partnered with USIP, the United States Institute of Peace, to bring together, again, a group of Chinese academics and U.S. academics and some government officials, both Chinese and U.S., to look at areas where China and the U.S. could be collaborating more effectively together. And moving into a shared security model. So this was an opportunity to look very much at a practicing level at what shared security can look like as a lived-into model between nations. So at the convening we had in Ningxia last year, we had Larry Forbes, who was a former Assistant Secretary of Defense. We had high-level Chinese officials and military and academics, all kind of looking at areas where the U.S. and China could move beyond competition and into models of cooperation. So we continued that conversation, and it was actually really interesting. We saw things begin to really loosen up by the latter part of this second convening, where people kind of moved beyond presenting to each other and kind of posturing in some of the ways that are very reflexive. And began to really get excited about ideas together and ask people questions about their respective contexts. And so it was a great convening and a great model that we'll continue to build on. I'll hand it back now.
Sorry, I was muted. Thank you very much. It's very, very exciting, and it's great to hear it in how it's being built out. It's really exciting to hear it, and I don't think I've even heard it in such detail. So we're going to open it up for questions and comments from all of you, and some of you I may have muted you, and now I'm unmuting you. So what questions or comments, guys? And one of the then that would be wonderful to hear from both of you is to talk a little bit about, you know, this the especially really powerful is the connection between the community level and the policy level, and what can Quakers or people do to support that kind of culture shift that you're proposing? And that would be really great to hear. And then love to hear any questions anyone else has.
I would just say quickly that helping people expand their imagination about what's possible, we often wait till crises are at their worst point before we have the conversation I referenced earlier, like, well, what would you do? Should we just let people die? And to be able to have a conversation that's a positive conversation, that's not a, you know, we're doing this all wrong conversation, but that's a, there are better ways. And here's what some of them might look like. Conversation, I think, is an opportunity that we've seen as transformative at a lot of different levels. I don't know, Alyssa, do you have some suggestions on that question?
Mine are not as, like, lovely and overarching. Mine is just, please watch your email because we will be trying to get a bill reintroduced in the House that talks about the issue I talked about in creating an exemption for peacebuilding and humanitarian work so that peacebuilders and humanitarian workers won't have to worry about these counterterrorism laws and their work can happen unimpeded. So that Laura's is one that you can do for, you know, trying to create this narrative and change ideas and that we need to do it kind of like invest in getting that 50-year shift happening. And mine is more what can happen for the next, like, let's say, 5 years.
Great. Or others, do others have comments or questions that they'd like to share? Don't be shy.
This seems, Ms. Susan Strong, seems abstract for us working at the local level. And it's wonderful work, and it has to be done. But in terms of how we take a next step with this booklet and the ideas, it's not extremely clear how we would do that. So that's my comment.
That's a good comment. And I think, I mean, what this is sort of a both and document. So I think, you know, those of us who work in a policy arena, certainly, and those of us who work in communities on the ground are often in kind of day-to-day meeting the crises that are coming our way. And we're really, I don't know about others, but I'll speak for myself. I've had a 20-year career of feeling like I'm just running around with Band-Aids and bandages trying to figure out how to make things a little less bad. And I think this is an effort to, in tandem with those efforts, to say how could things be different on a wholesale level? How could a different world be possible? That again isn't about sort of a utopia where conflict doesn't exist, but how could conflict be approached in a very different way? And you know, when you look at how the U.S. approaches something like like law enforcement at the local level, and kind of a militarized, highly militarized military style equipment. Very sort of, we must be a, you know, impose the law kind of framing. And you look at that compared to what we've seen as effective ways that kind of restorative justice approaches, where you look at what's driving a conflict, what could heal a conflict, what actually makes the situation better, not who needs to be punished. I guess our effort with this frame is to offer a different way we could be thinking about and talking about the challenges we face as a society. And I think what we're trying to do now, with some of the things like Alyssa was talking about and in our local communities, is to articulate how these alternatives are not just sort of things that can happen one place and one moment in time, but that we could make a whole scale shift in how we view our own security, what makes for our own well-being, what makes, and by when I say our own, that may be personal, that may be community, that may be our country, that may be humans. So I think, yes, it is abstract, but it's meant to sort of be an abstract complement to the concrete, if that makes any sense.
This is Lucy. I think it's also like Susan to talk about the community level. There's two instances that occur to me. One which Alyssa can talk about probably better than I can. But you know, like with police brutality at the community level right now, I work really closely with the local Black Lives Matter Coalition, and they're coming up with three demands that they're going to start to work on and build campaigns around. And one of them is, you know, ending stop and frisk, which is, you know, that's something that's going on. And then, but I think that the movement now that's happening in a lot of places for community police review boards that actually to whom the police are really accountable, I mean, that's a way to implement shared security in a kind of a deep way, that it's not just about a kind of police serving a control and, you know, the historical function and the way that they're serving a social control role, but really are responsive and accountable in a much deeper way to the community. And that's not rocket science. That's what's happened. That's what a lot of people are trying to get to happen. Mm-hmm. And then the other one, which is really right now hard to talk about, but it's been happening for a long time in Burundi, given what's happened with the coup, with the recent coup and what's going on, and Alyssa can talk more about that than I can. But I really do think that the Healing and Rebuilding Our Communities model of bringing people across a conflict together to do deep trauma healing together is hugely transformational on the community level. And I know that Healing and Rebuilding Our Communities is working to try to, and AFSC in different places as well, in our Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Maine, which is I'm sure you know about, it's a Truth and Reconciliation Commission between the Wabanaki and the state around child welfare and around removals of the Wabanaki from their homes. And I think that those are really, for me, on the ground community examples of what it looks like when you do this and implement it in a real way in the community. But Alyssa, do you want to say anything else about?
Just sort of actually about both of those. One, because I know sometimes, like, when you look at these documents and it's like, you know, I'm from New York City. New York City feels pretty far away from Mogadishu. But when I talk to folks about kind of like these kind of like shared security concepts, you know, I try to take it like pretty close to home, you know. In a lot of the New York City schools, when there's violence in the schools, the response is metal detectors. And I think, unfortunately, that happens across the country. The response is metal detectors. The response may be guards in the schools. People are getting expelled a lot. And in Somalia, if you're a young person, what the response is from the international community often, if there is violence in your community or groups that the international community, you know, doesn't like in your community, the response is AMISOM and armed people who are going in to, you know, take down, in quotes, and the enemy. And that, you know, if you're a young person, you understand what it means to have a militarized response to problems that are going on in your community, problems that you want to try to figure out as well, or maybe problems that you got caught up in because it seemed like you didn't have any other choice. And that really what shared security is about is that whether you live in New York City or you live in Mogadishu, you know, the response is not supposed to be armed guards and metal detectors. The response is supposed to be people trying to figure out what the community needs and how to respond to the community so that, you know, what got you to the place where violence was happening at the first instance doesn't happen anymore. And then on the Burundi front, you know, one of the sections is about, you know, approaches to heal a broken world. And it's not so much focused on kind of like the restorative justice ideas in, you know, small communities, but kind of, you know, writ large and using the UN. But I think that, you know, zooming it sort of into, you know, communities and what it means to heal from traumatic experiences in a way that gets societies moving forward. Adrian Nyangabo, which I'm sure lots of people on this call have either talked to or heard from, he's a Burundian peace builder who was one of the people who kind of is at the foundation of healing and rebuilding our communities. When I met him, maybe the first time, was talking about, I kept saying trauma healing, and he was like, we don't really say trauma healing at HEROC. We talk about community healing, because trauma healing is about one person, but we're really trying to heal an entire community, and that, you know, that moving forward after times when violence has happened isn't about, you know, punishment, and I think we're doing a lot of discussions about that in the United States as well. He said, for one thing, you know, there's so many people who were had some kind of role in what happened that we would just send everybody to jail. And if we send everybody to jail, we're not building a new society and we're not building hope and a foundation for the future. And I think that, you know, that concept applies in Burundi the same as it applies in different places in the United States. And so that these, you know, concepts are mirroring each other, you know, in a really global way, and that progress on this idea in one place can support progress on this idea in another place. You know, and talking about like trauma healing, I'm on the board of the Alliance for Peacebuilding, and they did their first peacebuilding in the U.S. session at an AFP panel last week. And I said, you know, HEROC came to Boston, to Baltimore, because they were like, we know in Baltimore you have trauma because of, you know, militarized and violent experiences. And we want to talk to you about this tool that we have that's worked around Burundi that we think maybe might work for you as well. So, you know, really sharing these experiences, I think, is powerful and has a lot of salience for communities at the local level or can.
Thank you, Alyssa. I've been part of some conversations around initially dealing with police brutality and then going deeper to communities saying we need healing where the trauma in our communities is profound and it's playing out in some ways that we know aren't good, and we've got to do some deep work in our communities towards doing that healing. And knowing that there are models out there and the NFSC has connections to those that we can learn from is one thing to offer.
Yeah.
The other comment I had, this is Martha in New England, about how we can facilitate some of these conversations is AFSC has a new poster project that's part of this conversation of what is security. It's pretty easy, I think, to use, and it invites a lot of dialogue and creativity locally. The posters can be the impetus for different groups coming in and creating their own posters or having a conversation or doing some program work around the conversation of what is security.
Great. And it's called All of Us Are None, and it just, I think the website for it just launched, and you can, there's information about how to contact Mary Zirkle about hosting that. Any other comments or questions? Don't be shy.
Susan, are you still on this call?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Did that help? Did some of that help?
That was helpful. I was interested in this poster project. Is that something you can find on the AFSC website? Or?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember the URL for it, but it's probably easiest to find by putting AFSC in All of Us or None, which is the name of it,
so it's
searching in Google.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. You'll be hearing more about it as it launches.
Mm-hmm. So it's not really ready yet.
No, it's. I think it's ready. I don't know, Martha. Have you seen the website? Martha? I don't know.
I was muted. It is. I think it launched today. Maybe I have seen it when it wasn't quite complete. I think it's allofusandthems.afsc.org.
Mm. Us and them. Okay. Got it. .afsc.org. Thank you. Yes. So it is really ready. I mean, it's, and they're eager to get, to start adding people to the calendar to host as well.
It takes a few hours for several people to put it up, a couple hours. It's easier than the boycott poster exhibit, if you're familiar with that. In terms of, you don't have to put up all the posters. You can choose which ones work best for you, what you want to work on. If you want to put 10 of them up for an event, you can do that. So I'll have it for the month of July, and I'm looking at probably 6 or 7 different venues that will show it in.
And it's broad. It's really wonderful because it's really broadly representative of the connections between domestic issues and international issues, as well as the connections between issues themselves. So it's really great.
And then there's just lots of things that you can be creative with to use it. You can bring in a youth group and have a conversation and have them make posters and put their posters up on the wall. I think in one place they did some regular size paper reproductions of a couple of posters and put them in a cluster and created a place for people to take selfies and get them to put those out with comments. There are just lots of different things you can do with it. You can do a program on drones. You can do a program on security. You can do militarized policing. You can take it where you need to take it with this project.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Okay. Anything else that Alyssa or you want to add to your thoughts?
No, just to keep watch for developments on the peacebuilding and humanitarian activities exemption, because we'll really be able to use your support on this. It sounds like a really simple idea that peacebuilding should not have barriers because, you know, the goal is to create a situation where more people can live without fear in all countries. But, you know, often the roots, the ideas we have about how to achieve that goal are so different that it can be hard for policymakers to do some of these things that we're suggesting. And so sometimes they need a little bit of support to understand that, you know, folks really do want this to happen in these ways. So that should probably go out like on Wage Peace or something.
Yeah. Alyssa, I'm curious. There was a piece on public radio tonight about the Leahy Amendment that restricts federal funding to human rights abusers.
Yeah.
And it was about Afghanistan, and this police chief who's a known human rights abuser who's just, yeah, they'll keep giving me money. And how that, how do we hold on to the good stuff of that amendment or that legislation while freeing it up to deal with Burundi kind of situations?
Well, I mean, in Burundi, I'm not sure if I totally understand the question, but when I think about Leahy and Burundi, that's actually right now being used as a bit of a tool because the president asked for a third term. A lot of people thought that was unconstitutional and not in the spirit of Arusha. And one thing about Burundi is that they are a troop contributing country to the mission in Somalia, and which I kind of shorthand as Burundi is fighting the U.S. war on terror. And so what that gives Burundi is a lot of money and training for their military. And right now, one thing that the U.S. government has been able to say is, look, if your soldiers are committing human rights abuses, we will invoke the Leahy Law, and we will not, you know, train you and send you to be active in these types of activities, which I have to say was a surprise because usually, well, at times the U.S. has been known to overlook human rights abuses by people who were our allies. And so I would say in this situation, the Leahy Law is working in the way that some people had intended
okay.
it to.
Okay.
I know there are
something you were saying earlier about Burundi, I was a little confused. That's all.
Oh, yeah. No, it is very confusing, to be honest. Right now, there are so many changes going on day to day that there's a lot to be confused about. But one thing I will say is, you know, hopefully that we can all hold Burundi and the peace builders, many of whom belong to the Friends community, in the light during this time when it seems like people on both sides of the conflict are not listening to one another. And what we really need right now is some listening to happen. We're working actually on a Friends statement, a joint Friends statement from a lot of different Friends organizations around the world to try to sort of raise the profile of what's going on in Burundi and to really let people in Burundi know that we are with them and that we're on the side of peace and reconciliation, and especially to try to message to some of the leaders who are evangelical Friends to let them know that we are supporting the idea that, you know, individuals need to stop violence and really think about what's for the good of the country and how to rebuild all the progress that happened since the last peace settlement and what could happen in the future. So please put out some good thoughts for Burundi and those folks there.
I will. Thank you. So are there any last comments or thoughts? Okay. Well, thank you. Thanks to Aura and Alyssa. And I wanted to mention that this series of Calls for Spirited Action will be starting up again in October. And anyone who registered for the call will receive a survey so you can give us input about what kind of conversations you'd like to be a part of beginning again in October. And if you are interested in resources on shared security, there's the shared security website itself. There's going to be more and more things coming out of communications from AFSC, and there's obviously been more things coming from FCNL. And if you are interested in learning more about ways to engage on the issues that AFSC works on with us, in partnership with us, or you are already working on some of the issues that we're working on, you can find some resources, particularly for Quakers, at AFSC.org/friends and AFSC.org/friends/resources. So take a look there. And I really appreciate Aura and Alyssa presenting and the conversation, and I have a deeper understanding of the this again, even though I've been familiar with it for a while, and especially where we're going with it in the next little while. And I really appreciate you doing that. And if you enjoyed this call and found it beneficial, the recording will be at the Calls for Spirited Action page. All of the calls that we did this year are available there. So you can check those out and share those with other people. So any last thoughts before we close down the call?
I was also just going to say, and thank you to Lucy for organizing these calls and having us.
Yeah, well, thank you for doing
thank
this.
You.
Thank you, Lucy.
And thank you all for joining. I really, really appreciate it. And share what you've heard and let other people know about these resources and about these ideas. Thanks very much, and good night.